This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Stephanie Officer. A father from Canada pleads not guilty after being charged in the death of his 9-year-old daughter. New York State Police say Luciano Fertolin reported his daughter abducted after a family vacation. Authorities report her body was found in a pond Sunday.
Police say Fratolin murdered his daughter. Melina lived with her mother, who was estranged from the father. Police say the mom had not been worried about the father-daughter trip.
ABC's Aaron Katursky. A new aviation tragedy overseas. Officials in Bangladesh say a military plane crashed during a training mission Monday, killing children when a school was hit. ABC's Tom Sufi-Burridge.
At least 20 people killed, more than 100 injured. Students rushing in to help as fierce flames and heavy smoke engulfed the building in the capital, Dhaka, trapping many inside. First responders pouring water on the wreckage, searching for survivors. Officials say the jet crashed into the second floor of the building, filled with third and fourth graders. The youngest victim, just 5 years old.
This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers head to Seattle. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball tonight, the Brewers opening a 3-game series against the Mariners at T-Mobile Park. The Brewers with a 6-5 win yesterday on the road against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Manager Pat Murphy, pleased with catcher Eric Haas and shortstop Joey Ortiz.
It felt good that we kept grinding at bats out. They know how they have to play. And, you know, Eric Haas, you know he doesn't get to play very much, getting a big RBI. Oh, two outs, you know, Ortiz, what can you say about the way the guy plays? Play defensive.
The Brewers have now won 10 in a row. NFL Packers reporting to Green Bay for the start of Wednesday's first day of practice. Linebacker Quay Walker, physically unable to perform. He's been dealing with that ankle injury at the end of last season.
Hard to say. I think I just do too much thinking, to be honest with you. Instead of just going out there and just play. Half is making me think, whatever the case may be, it just be me trying to do everything right instead of just lining up and just playing. I can be a real, real productive player.
That's Packers linebacker Quay Walker with Sports on Mike Clemens.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. All weekend, I couldn't help but think of the old country song, 16 Tons. You know the song. You load 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. I owe my soul to the company store. Same as it always has been. And look, the Democrats joined in with the Republicans again in a sign of true corporate bipartisanship to sell out the working class once again. And this is why, as a Democrat, I am angry with the Democrats. I expect this from Republicans. Wholeheartedly expect Republicans to screw over the working class at every opportunity. But here, to have Democrats sign on with a president who's eager to get his meme coin on, you kind of got to wonder. Now, I'm told, no, Rick, you know, all of your fears, you're going to be fine. There are protections here. We're just regulating it. Yeah, I'm not buying it. And as Congress pats itself on the back and corporate lobbyists are popping their champagne, I'm not buying the Genius Act. Sorry. I'm not fooled by the shiny name. For me, it's just another scam wrapped up in patriotic language. It's a digital leash pretending to be innovation. They want us to thank them for tightening up the regulations. I don't know. Now you have this brought to you by these tech startups, by surveillance software companies. And instead of handing out coins that only work at the company store or the slips that they used to have back in the day when, you know, you sold your soul to the company store and you could only use that company script at the company store or the company doctor where you sold your soul. Now we're going to have a digital wallet that you cannot escape. Controlled, tracked, and drained by fees before you even get to buy your groceries. Folks, this is an innovation. Sorry. It's a reboot of corporate feudalism. And right now you got both parties who are in on it. And while we're scraping to get by, they're shaking hands, patting each other on the back, writing laws that are going to let billionaires privatize how we get paid, where we spend, and what we're allowed to do. Bipartisanship. And, you know, go back to all of the moments of bipartisanship where people go, oh, look, this worked out so well. Go back to the Clinton years with the telecom bill in 96. Go back to the welfare reform. Go back to the Carter trucking deregulation. Go back to airline deregulation where kumbaya. Did it work out for working people? Because it worked great for the wealth class. It was the rest of us who suffered the slow economic strangulation. So now we're moving into a world where you're going to get your paycheck in a corporate-controlled currency, usable inside their approved ecosystem. Imagine Amazon, the last retailer to ever exist, saying, yep, we're not going to let you go to any other store. You've got to buy it from Amazon. You get Amazon points. Try paying your rent or buy gas. Better hope your landlord or your gas station is in network, kind of like your health insurance. And don't complain, not too loudly anyway, because your account could be frozen or throttled without warning. Sound paranoid? Look around. The infrastructure is already being built, not to protect us, but to control us. And don't believe for a second that that digital-only money or centralized payment system makes us free, because it doesn't. They make us absolutely dependent on the same tech overlords buying up Washington and lobbying for this nonsense. Digital money can be programmed to expire, to be blocked, to block purchases, or to reward for good behavior. Now ask yourself, who gets to decide what good means? I don't know. Especially in a system built by corporate America. I've got my Red Hat crew, who for a couple of years now have been freaking out over the Democrats are going to bring the social credit score to America, to where if I say racist stuff, they're going to cut off my money, to where if I'm homophobic, they're going to cut off my money. I literally know people who believe this because they've been told Democrats are coming for them. And oddly enough, it's Trump who is moving, Trump and the Republicans, with the help of Democrats now, who are moving into a direction where all of their fears could come true. We should be talking to our friends, our neighbors, our co-workers. There is a creeping sense that we're not in charge anymore. That the real government is delivered via app updates and algorithmic decisions. Do we have much of a say anymore? The thing that's weird to me is you go to a sporting event, go to a concert, go to anything, nobody takes cash anymore. It's all Apple Pay. It's all Google Pay. It's all digital currency. Sorry, we don't take cash anymore. We don't take America's currency. We're going to be moving toward, and quickly, privatizing our currency. This is what happens when the commons gets carved out and handed off to private kings. You know, the Musks of the world. It ain't government of the people anymore. It's government subcontracted through billionaires. And while the red and blue teams swap press releases, working people like you and me are going to get deeper in debt, locked out of decision-making, and shut down when we dare to ask questions. If this is the kind of bipartisanship we get, no thank you. It's time for working people to demand better, to demand more. But Rick, it's innovation. It's going to make our lives easier. It's all right there on our phone. You know, the thing that tracks your every movement? I know, I'm sounding conspiratorial. Sadly, in high school, I read 1984, a book that they are now trying to ban and have been trying to ban for quite a while. I wonder why. I wonder why they would want to do that. I would wonder why they want to destroy the Department of Education. I wonder why they want to privatize our education system while simultaneously privatizing every function of a government that is supposed to be of, for, and by we the people. Got to ask yourself, you okay with this? You okay with a digital currency that can be tracked every purchase you make? Scrutinized, where if you get sick, you go, hey, look what you bought. Are you comfortable with a country that operates like that? And understand, nowhere to go, because once this takes off, this is global. There's nowhere to go. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week we talked about the Supreme Court's decision to allow Trump to dismantle the Department of Education and fire, you know, what, 1,400 employees at the drop of a hat? And this is, again, why elections, why they kind of matter. But what's it going to mean if Trump does get to destroy the Department of Education? What if he gets his wet dream? What happens to education in this country? Does it splinter? Do we privatize, profitize? What's it going to look like? And here to answer some of those questions, I've asked our good friend Randy Weingarten to come share some thoughts. Randy's the president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course.
So let's start with that. Last Monday, you had the Supreme Court decided, yeah, go ahead. You know, just dismantle the Department of Education, fire 1,400 people. Yeah, go ahead. What does that leave us?
So essentially, what it says is that the department cannot do its job. And its job was to help support education, particularly students in public schools, particularly poor, marginalized, vulnerable students, like kids with disabilities, kids who are learning English, kids who are poor or working class, and kids who are going to college and can't afford steep tuitions, so they got subsidies from the federal government. And then essentially it said, That's one big mandate of the department. The second mandate, when I say mandate, right from Congress, the second mandate of the department is they are civil rights agency. So it means if there's an anti-Semitic incident against a kid feeling unsafe, they could have gone to one of these regional offices of the Office of Civil Rights. If a kid is discriminated against because a child is African-American, because a child had a disability, they could go to one of these regional offices. The regional offices are going to be gone. So if you're a parent and somebody just says, oh, you have to go to Washington to actually get your kid some degree of settling of a grievance, or the fact that your kid is not getting the services, and you live in the middle of Ohio and you can't afford the trip to Washington, then you get screwed. So essentially what I'm trying to say is that the Department of Education doesn't run one school. There's not one school it runs. Never has. You know, we never wanted it to.
So what do you say to the person?
It supported things, and all of that is going to be decimated and derailed.
No, you know, the vast majority of people, though, do they have an interaction with the Department of Education? Because one of the responses I've got is, well, we don't need it. We'll take that money. We'll put it into the classroom, because that's the argument that I've been getting most often. We don't need bureaucrats. We need more teachers, which should be, you know, music to your ears.
But guess what? The department, and I'm not saying that the department should have been more efficient. I think all the bureaucrats should be more. I think all of these bureaucracies should be more efficient. I completely agree with that. But what will happen now when, you know, say Title I gets plopped into the money that goes for 26 million kids? It's supposed to go directly to schools. Say what happens is it gets plopped into, in Austin, Texas, Abbott's hands. And he says, oh no, I don't want to give it to schools. I want to give it to my friends. Who's going to be there to actually say, no, it has to go to San Antonio to this particular school for these kids? Who's going to be there to do that? What it's going to mean is that people like myself, like the NEA, we're going to be suing all the time to get what should happen. So there's no accountability then for how you spend the dollars. But I agree with the folks that are saying there's too much bureaucracy. Yeah, of course there's too much bureaucracy. I don't want the bureaucracy about the test takers. I don't want the bureaucracy that the testing companies have created, or have, you know, or the account, or the this, you know, those who are trying to measure standardized tests. I think we should have less standardized tests. We should have less of that. But you have nobody to answer the phone when somebody who has a student loan says, wait a second, Mohila is not servicing my loan. You just sent me to a credit company. I need to get this fixed. Nobody's answering the phone. So what we're doing is, in this huge getting rid of the department, we are actually saying that the oversight to make sure that vulnerable kids and poor kids get what they deserve won't happen.
So if I'm hearing you right, because the idea that I've been told is that this is part of the DOGE, we're gonna be more efficient, we're gonna save money, we're gonna shrink government because we're savings, all of that. What it sounds like is it's gonna actually be much more costly.
This is not a shrinking, this is not efficiency, it's evisceration. If you have a core function of civil rights and you basically get rid of all the regional offices, how are you doing your core function? If you have a core function of making sure that the 45 million young people, not so young people, get their loan service, their student loan service, that's, you know, that's what was placed, plopped in the Department of Education as one of their jobs when the outside private student loan servicers so screwed things up, they made it a federal government responsibility. If nobody's answering the phone, what's going to happen if somebody needs to actually figure out what they owe in terms of their debt and their student debt?
So would you argue this is privatization? Because I've said, look, they want to privatize all of our government functions. Well, all of this is part of it.
That's separate. That is actually a separate thing. This is actually making the public function not work, so nobody believes in the federal function or the public function for education.
Yeah, but Randy, that's been their talking point for my entire lifetime. Republicans have always told me government can't, shouldn't, and we won't let it work or operate or do it. Everything should be in the purview of the private sector.
And so let me just say, there's a second piece there, Rick, which is a privatization thing that they did in this big ugly bill. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to make public schools not work. They're trying to create distrust in public schools. They're trying to say, oh, these grants don't work anymore. They've disabled the way that they work. They say, oh, now they don't work anymore. And then they say, see, the only option is private schools. This is part of their plan. I mean, frankly, I just wrote a whole book about this called Why Fascists Fear Teachers.
Yeah, and I want to get to that.
This is part of their plan. Disable, defund, decimate the public school system, because our job is all kids. Our job is not some kids. Our job is all kids, is helping meet the needs of all kids.
And I would take
decimate,
it to the next.
Disable that. And then they also, in this big ugly bill, they also created a tax credit that is double the size of the amount of money that goes to poor kids and kids with disabilities. But you tell me, if you have a kid who is disabled and you can't get the services for that kid, and that state government is not doing it, and you can't get anybody on the phone in the federal government, please.
Yeah, who do you go
that's
to?
Not efficiency. That's evisceration.
No, and that's the point. The point is, and this, they've been very clear about this, yeah. But I would take it even further than just destroying and privatizing it. It's controlling it. And I look at, you know, Trump's executive order last Thursday, you know, they went Schedule F, we're going to fire everybody. Now, Schedule G, evidently we got a new letter in the schedule that we're going to be able to make patronage great again. And look, during the campaign, I was saying that the entire time. Trump's going to make patronage great again, and this is part of that. So for me, you destroy the institution that's been there for years. You bring in your loyalists, people who know which executive order is the best because they can write it down, how wonderful Trump's executive orders are. And now you've got an army of sycophants and true believers. Yeah. And I don't think that's good for individuals, but I don't think it's good for the country.
Well, look, it was a Republican president, Theodore Roosevelt, who started and helped start the nonpartisan civil service, because you want people who work for government who will call balls and strikes without doing it from an ideological lens. And that is what's being destroyed by this Republican president.
Now, are those John Roberts balls and strikes?
You know, I'm talking about Teddy's balls and strikes. Teddy Roosevelt.
I mean, think
about it. But at the end of the day, you already see, regardless of what they are saying, there's a new AP poll out these last few days that says that less than 25% of the people in America think any of the policies that Trump has done has helped them. So now what they're trying to do, and you see it with the redistricting, the racing to try to do, now they're just one more time trying to rig the game. So instead of hiring people who would say, look, how many people would say to Joe Biden who was in the federal workforce, no, you can't do this. This is against the law. How many times have we said that the Justice Department should be neutral? I mean, look at what the Justice Department did, whether you agree or disagree. They indicted the president's kid based upon what they saw as the rule of law. You want the federal government, you want state governments, you want them to be in service of the people, not in service of whoever the current president is. They should work hard for the people. But since Reagan, they have tried to basically create distrust in government. And now this particular government is saying, distrust all the people that came before me, but I'm going to put my own people in. So it's the corruption and the control is different than a Ronald Reagan.
which leads me to your upcoming book this September, just in time for school, A Great Education Thing, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education, and the Future of Democracy. And I go, look, you know, I'm listening to you go through this bit of history, and I'm going, this is why you've got to destroy education. You can't control people if they have actual information and not alternative right. reality and alternative facts.
I mean, I think what's happened, and you and I have talked about this a lot, and, you know, I started thinking about this book when I was sitting in my office, which I am right now, and on January 6th, and I watched the attempted coup that happened on January 6th. I could see it from my office. And I said to myself, how can people be so angry, so mad? And look, I work for people who every single day are trying to get a better life and are trying to change the laws so that we get a better life, trying to change collective bargaining, trying to change so that they can have higher wages, lower class size, opportunities. So I understand this anger, but how there could be so much anger that our democracy would be at risk. That's what happens. It's not the people themselves. It's the controllers. It's the demagogues. It's the dictators. It's the authoritarians. It's the fascists that create this us versus them. And one of the things they do is they try to demonize educators. And why do they try to demonize educators like Chris Rufo did, like Mike Pompeo did to me, calling me the most dangerous person in the world? Why? Because there is a fear of knowledge and a fear of pluralism. And I would say, and this is what this book says, I would root for the people in schools and the kids and the families we serve. Let them think. Let them critically think. Let them problem solve. Let's make sure we give them the skills and knowledge to be whoever they're going to be. And let's make sure we have a democracy so that a Liz Cheney can fight with me about economics or vice versa. But let's have that democracy.
No, it's easier just to call you an evil, nasty person.
Yeah. So that's why I wrote this book. It is about answering the question, why is this fear of knowledge? Why is this fear of pluralism? And then it is also, frankly, a love story to a lot of teachers. And I tell a lot of stories about what teachers are doing to create critical thinking, to create safe and welcoming environments, to build opportunity for children. People whose names you probably would never have known until you read the book, because that's the millions of school teachers across the country who work in great anonymity, who are doing extraordinary things.
Now, look, I still talk about, you know, teachers I had, you know, 40 plus years ago. And it's one of those things that I want for future generations.
Right.
Last thing I want to get to is, you know, it's about information. It's about, you know, about critical thinking, as you've said.
Yeah.
But
me just say, it's out in September, but people want it. They can pre-order it now. There's lots of ways of pre-ordering, but they can go to just type in their Google search, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, and they can figure out how to pre-order it.
And we'd like to have you come back and when it's out and promote it again. But I want to get your thoughts on this Greg Gutfeld quote from the other day. It's really one of the most disgraceful things I've seen. He said, we need to learn from the blacks the way they were able to remove the power from the N-word by using it. So from now on, he says, what's up, my Nazi? Hey, what's up, my Nazi? Hey, what's hanging, my Nazi? Because he wants to normalize the word Nazi. I got to tell you, if you had a reasonable education, especially talking about history, that would be, I don't know, there'd be a reason to change the channel.
I feel very sorry for him, that he feels like he has to be so performative, that in his words, in the using those words create great fear. They create great anguish. They create great terror. And maybe he didn't know a person who was killed by the Nazis, who was in a concentration camp, who was starved to death. Maybe you never knew anyone like that. But to think that you can normalize what people had done to deprave other people, frankly, I don't understand why Murdoch didn't take him off TV. It is depraved indifference to other people. It's not funny.
No.
And for every one of us who had family who died in the Holocaust, shame on him.
The right response. Randy, as always, I appreciate the time. Great talk with you. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon, especially when the book comes out.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, our good friend Randy Weingarten. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM. As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy tonight, a chance of showers and storms, warm and muggy with lows in the low 70s. And a mix of sun and clouds for tomorrow, scattered storms around, humid with highs in the upper 80s. Partly sunny, more heat and humidity Wednesday, high mid-90s, a few storms. Right now it's 76.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
I imagine we'll talk about Superman. It's the same thing I said about F1. It's a great video. The music is great. The action's great. The CGI is great. I don't feel like they had to really develop the characters. It was fine.
I thought They did a really good job of showing Superman's, humility.
I agree with you there. One of my positives, it wasn't 2 hours and 40 minutes like every other blockbuster movie this summer, but lots to like there.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the polling numbers, interesting on this whole Epstein thing. And remember, this administration was going to be transparent, remember? They were going to blow the lid off the whole Epstein scandal. We were going to find out. And not surprising, this new CBS YouGov poll finds 75% of us not happy with the administration's handling of what's going on with the Epstein files. And 89% want the Justice Department to release all of the information. Again, remember, we were told transparency. This was the guy who was going to blow up the deep state, of which a lot of my red hat friends, they saw Epstein as part of that. And here to share some thoughts on, well, is this going to be the thing that brings Trump down? Will this be Trump's Waterloo? That's why I've asked our good friend Sarah Burris to come share some thoughts. Sarah's a reporter at Raw Story. RawStory.com, the website, if you want to check out the work that she does. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, how are you?
Good. So what do you think of this? I'm surprised, shocked. Any thoughts that this issue, not taking food out of the mouths of children, not kicking granny off Medicaid, not going after the disabled, the poor, all that, that this issue, this is what's got the American people united.
I am not surprised. But the thing is I think this is really just the beginning. What we've seen with the Big Beautiful Bill is that, the consequences are going to come quicker than I think people fully realize. And already you're seeing clinics and stuff shut down. So I, to some extent, I wonder how much this Epstein stuff was an attempt at distraction and a really, really bad one about Trump's failings on the economy. I don't necessarily know that Trump has ever really made a good decision involving Jeffrey Epstein. But remember the first administration, whenever he said it was the most transparent administration in history?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think we already knew that Democrats and independents were heavily skeptical. They're already super mad about the economy. So now you're just adding in more people into the tent of hacked off Americans.
No, I see this as, you know, I see this as going after the base, because the base were the true believers. They're the ones who bought it. Look, I believe that he's, you know, eyeball deep into whatever Epstein Island was, all of that stuff, all of the comments that we've talked about over the years, from wanting, you know, saying he'd be dating his daughter to going and checking out the girls, the preteen or the teen universe pageant, you know, all of that stuff, all the creepy stuff he said on Howard Stern, all of that, it's there. Nobody bought it. I'm just, yeah, why this? Now, what's interesting is the Wall Street Journal claims that, you know, he wrote Epstein this letter in the shape of a woman that any teenage boy in you know, algebra class would draw. He's now suing the Wall Street Journal. Do you think this is the thing that's going to bring him down?
No, it won't be the thing that brings him down, but it is joyous because you've heard the comment that you don't pick fights with people who buy ink by the barrel. Granted, that's not the way media works anymore, but come on, Rupert Murdoch, are you really going to sue the Wall Street Journal and Rupert Murdoch? And apparently Dow Jones and News Corp. And I mean, he threw in a whole bunch and it's for $10 billion. I was at that point, I was just like, why not just make it like 11 gazillion?
Exactly.
And they're like,
yeah. Or more importantly, if it really is the issue, just $1. I want the truth. This isn't about money. This is about the truth. The fact that it's $10 billion tells me that, well, what he has done his entire life is do these obscene, frivolous lawsuits and then settle back for pennies because, you know, ABC or whomever decides it's cheaper to pay you off than it is to fight and you know, keep their name. I don't know that the Wall Street Journal is going to do that this time.
I don't think so at all. I don't think Murdoch will either. With CBS, it was very clear that it was about, you know, the merger and trying to make sure that Paramount could be in a good position so that whenever they were purchased, that the FCC would allow them to move through, allow the merger to move through. ABC, I'm fairly certain, was probably about Discovery. I think they were probably thinking that the worst possible thing could be that Donald Trump goes through the emails of every single reporter at ABC and what they've said about him. So that doesn't surprise me. He backed down. You remember the lawsuit he did against the pollster in Iowa?
Yeah.
He backed off of that one, just withdrew the whole thing. So it's kind of all over the place here, where I think if Rupi just genuflexes, Trump may back down. At the very least, I think the biggest problem is, again, this whole Discovery thing where he's suing for libel. So you have to prove that what they said was false, and then you have to prove that they did it with a malicious intent. So basically all the Wall Street Journal has to do is go, this picture? You mean this one doesn't exist?
and those really creepy ones that were fairly risque with his young daughter sitting on his lap. And as a parent, I you look at those and I just go, I'm not a billionaire, but no.
Yeah. I mean, that just looks skeevy. But the thing about Trump is that he's really, really good at being creepy. So here we are. And what's been interesting to me, too, is to watch the Republicans and how they've tried to figure out a way that they can blame Democrats for this. And their favorite comment that they've started making is,
yep.
Well, you guys had 4 years in the White House and you didn't release any of this stuff.
Yeah, because they were busy doing their freaking jobs, like trying to fix the economy that Trump screwed up, like trying to ensure that kids get education, trying to make sure that the roads and the bridges don't collapse. I don't know. Other things that were a little more important than Trump's ego.
I don't even want to have that fight. I just want to reply with, so you want to release them then? You know, like
there's the other one.
I don't even care what was happening 4 years ago. We're here right now. So you want to release these, right?
I want to see him, because here's the thing. And this is where my MAGA, my red hat friends They were so fire confident that, you know, Bill Clinton's on the list. This was them getting Bill Clinton. And that was the target for most of my Red Hat friends. So we're going to get those Democrats who rip the heads off babies and drink their blood, all that craziness. And now that the sainted one, that that Orange Julius is quite possibly on that list. Yeah, it's been an interesting silence.
I don't know how you rationalized that all of the skeezy photos and videos of Trump with Epstein meant that somehow he wasn't on the list.
Yeah.
Like, you don't see a lot of other videos of people dancing around with the white man overbite with Jeffrey Epstein. It's the Trump video. So I'm just trying to figure out, like, why would they think that that there would be something else, like some magical excuse for maybe he was going over there to save people.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays itself out. And it's not going away. As much as Trump wants to say, nothing to see here, move along. The Q-Kook base, I don't think they're going to let this go. I think it's going to be very interesting what comes up in the next 6 months, because we've just had 6 months, celebrated yesterday, 6 months of chaos, 6 months of insanity, 6 months of, as Trump truthed out, the most consequential presidency, I guess, what did he say? One of the most consequential periods of any president. And I don't disagree. We are in one of the most consequential periods in this country's history as we march headlong into fascism.
Ain't no way Trump knows what consequential means, first of all. Secondly, you're right. It is certainly we are facing the consequences of the 24 election. And I just want to remind everybody, we have 3.5 years of this. What we have dealt with in the last 6 months will go on for 3.5 more years. Yeah. But here's the thing.
What about the eggs, man? I just bought eggs. They haven't come down any. Gas prices are higher than they were a year ago, even though Trump said a year ago the country was dead. And look, more Americans are finally coming around while Trump's approval ratings are in the very low 40s. You know, people worried about, you know, the inflation. The last polling, 64% disapproved of Trump's handling on an inflation issue. That's up 10 points from March. And we've got some stuff to kick off here in a couple of days. Can't get any better.
So the inflation numbers are interesting because it started to track down. When was that? Like maybe September, October of last year. And so they were on a really good trajectory. I feel like Biden sort of handed him okay, we've done all the right things. Here you go. And what we've seen now is that downturn has sort of ticked up. So for the first time we saw inflation, instead of going down, it went back up again. And you're right, gas prices are not cheaper, the price of eggs is not cheaper, groceries in general are not cheaper. If I have to pay $2 for my yogurt shakes, I'm going to be so furious, because during COVID they were $1.19 and I have been watching them go up for years now.
Yeah, no, look, I do all the grocery shopping. I do all the shopping now. So I'm now more keenly aware of what prices are. And they've actually gone up, you know, where you go, wasn't that just this much yesterday? It seems like corporate America isn't buying in.
No, they're not. And I think, too, we're still facing the tariffs, right? Like there are all of these, the whole 90 deals and 90 days thing. It turned out we only had 2 deals, maybe 2.5 deals. They are not with huge countries. Like we don't have a legitimate deal with China. We don't have a deal with the EU. So things like wine and cheese and yada yada are one thing, but even the deal that he made with Indonesia last week. So Indonesia is a huge producer of denim. So Levi's, right, are coming from Indonesia and a few other countries. So as you go back to school and start buying clothes for the kids, denim's going to be a lot higher because Trump decided, okay, well, Indonesia is going to allow all American goods into the country without them having to pay any tariffs. But Indonesian goods, we're still going to have to deal with a 30% tariff. So your jeans are going to be 30% higher now.
Yeah, but, you know, as someone who does believe in the use of tariffs in an overall strategic, you know, strategy, I do know that that doesn't all get passed along. It may this time. We don't know yet. But my problem is this isn't the answer to our solution. This isn't going to bring manufacturing back. This isn't going to do what they seem to think. And this idea that, well, we're going to bring money in. You're right. That's all about raising taxes on people instead of what the goal that I want is to reshore manufacturing.
And I think it's one of the major things about, if you remember the states that do the tax-free school shopping, they have the tax-free day when everybody can go and buy stuff without dealing with a sales tax. That is for, you know, to try and make key goods like school supplies and clothes and stuff like that cheaper. So we're now, it's not just about, you know, Christmas toys in December. Now it's about, you know, when your kid grows out of the sneakers, when your kid grows out of the jeans, you got to buy a new pair, and now it's going to be super expensive. Yeah. I love Goodwill. I'm just saying.
No, look, we're in for an interesting bit of rough road ahead. And again, the first 6 months were the most consequential, according to Trump, and I don't disagree. It'll be interesting to see what the next 6 months brings us. Now, some polling, you know, from what I've seen, immigration was supposed to be the strong suit of the administration. Lots of folks were all on board, you know, go get them. We now see a story of we did a prisoner swap.
Oh, my God. So last week, after all of these lawsuits where the White House, where the Trump administration has said that they can't bring any of the people back from the brutal crazy gulag prison in El Salvador. Now it turns out we did a prisoner swap with Venezuela, where 10 Americans who were in, in prison in Venezuela were released back to the United States. And we exchanged 250 people who were in the CECOT prison who were from Venezuela back to Venezuela. So really, this was just a hostage situation the whole time. At the same time, though, we were also paying El Salvador for all of those guys being there. So now I'm like, are we still paying El Salvador? Like, how many people are left? You know, was this the plan all along?
And who are these 10? I mean, are these people who, with the raids that are going on, are these people who got swept up? Because I was told no Americans were swept up in any of this stuff. If that's the case, then who are these 10?
So these 10 were people who were in Venezuela. They were either political prisoners or otherwise confined. The state had them, knew where they were. And so this was, you know, an actual prisoner swap. These weren't, you know, Americans who got caught up. There may have been, you know, some people in CECOT that got caught up in the deportations. It's been a complete crisis where, I want to say it was Representative Maxwell Frost said that he went down to the Alcatraz, and one of the things that he heard people screaming from the back of the massive room was, I'm an American. I'm an American citizen. And so there, we know for certain that American people are getting scooped up by ICE. And now I just saw an ad where where Homeland Security is trying to get more agents because they can't meet the quota that the White House has set for them.
Right.
So they've offered up to $50,000.
Wow. Imagine if we did that for teachers.
As a signing bonus.
Imagine if we did that for teachers, that, you know, we would have no teacher shortage.
That's for sure.
But, you know,
and teachers would be able to afford food without food stamps.
Yeah, maybe even supplies too. Who knows? Who knows? Mm-hmm. But the reason I bring this up is, you know, I've had people say, "Well, you know, if you get swept up, you know, you just go to court and you make your case and you show your documents, show your papers." And I'm going, "Who are you going to show it to? If they're not allowing you to go to court, there's no habeas corpus. There's none of that. There's no due process. Who are you showing stuff to?"
This is the problem with saying, you know, immigration courts have been able to decide. you know, what whether somebody is a legitimate American or an undocumented immigrant or somebody who had their status somehow pulled. The sad thing is that without due process, with basically just deciding to deport folks to a third party country where they don't even have any ties to it, you really don't even know at this point whether, you know, an American could have been caught up in this and now is getting deported to South Sudan.
And that is the scary part. That's the scary part, because we don't know. And I've had some people email me hoping that I get swept up and deported.
Well, isn't that precious?
It is precious. And I'm glad that people are thinking. I'm glad people are thinking about me and my travel plans.
Right, right. Because everybody wants to spend the summer in South Sudan.
There you go. Sarah, as always, great stuff. Keep up the great work. What are you looking at this week? What are you focusing on in the coming week?
So the polling is going to be really interesting. I know that everybody's going to be watching Epstein. This is going to keep going on. The Epstein thing's going to keep going on. I really am trying to watch more about the economy and what's happening with inflation.
Yeah.
I'm also curious to see if Trump's going to try and fire Jerome Powell. That's going to be huge because he's trying to come up with cause now.
Yeah.
And it's all about the
guy that Biden, nominated and kept in there. You mean that guy?
I love that part where you just see Donald Trump. I guess that was like a Freaky Friday day where like Biden and Trump switched bodies and somehow Biden made Trump appoint Jerome Powell. Who knew?
It was all Biden. Again, Trump's got it in his own head, all the bad stuff Biden did, even when it was his stuff. But Sarah, mm-hmm. as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time.
Thanks. Have a good rest of the week.
You as well, our good friend Sarah Burris. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1878. That was the day that a new song was introduced to the U.S. labor movement. Reverend Jesse H. Jones set the lyrics of a poem that had been written by I.G. Blanchard more than a decade earlier. The song was called The 8-Hour Day. The fight for 8 hours had become one of the central causes of labor. In 1850, the average work week was 70 hours. This meant that workers had little time for anything else beside their daily toil. After the Civil War, calls for the 8-hour day gained momentum. It became a movement that united workers from different workplaces and backgrounds. 8-hour leagues were formed in cities across the nation. They hosted talks and rallies to spread the word about the need to shorten the work week. At rallies, protesters waved 8-hour banners. They also sang the song that became their anthem. The first verse boldly began, "We mean to make things over. We are tired of toil for naught, with but bare enough to live upon, and never an hour for thought. We want to feel the sunshine. We want to smell the flowers. We are sure that God has willed it, and we mean to have 8 hours. We're summoning our forces from the shipyard, shop, and mill. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will." The 8-Hour Day song continues to be reimagined today, including this version by Rhythm Fest. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, new Wall Street Journal piece out on SpaceX. And surprise, turns out that, while Trump wanted to cut Elon Musk's contracts, but too vital to our national security. And, you know, the weird thing is we've handed America's defense and our global reach to the likes of Elon Musk and a handful of billionaires who control corporate America. And look, this isn't just a matter of business contracts or innovation. This is a classic example of privatizing what were the commons, puts us and the nation at the mercy of these private interests, of these billionaires and these hedge funds. This isn't the public good. You know, take a hard look at the numbers. SpaceX has locked down $22 billion plus in government contracts since 2023, with $14 billion tied directly to national security and defense. The National Security Space Launch Program, the NSSL program alone, you're looking at almost $14 billion. As of July of 2025, SpaceX now commands 28 of the 54 critical launches. That's over 60% of the program. And that's through 2032, I think. Making it the most critical player in our defense. So when Trump wanted to try and cut Musk at the knees because their bromance was breaking up, what they found is SpaceX had contracts that were so essential that we couldn't cut them without jeopardizing our national security and our military readiness. So instead of we the people being in control of our own destiny, we got a single CEO with a bad attitude now controlling part of our defense. Now, it wasn't always like this. We invested in our future. When Kennedy launched the space program, it wasn't with the billionaire class in mind. It was with we the people in mind. And the thing is every time one of those rockets goes up in the air, those are dollars flowing into private hands. Core knowledge that's supposed to be in the hands of we the people, now proprietary in the hands of a few. And again, we go through this with everything. We've privatized a good control of our water, our sewer, our turnpikes. Every time we turn these things over, what we end up doing is, well, giving away a little bit more of our autonomy, a little bit more of our freedom, a little bit more of our ability to determine what we want our country to look like. And now that you've got SpaceX controlling the satellites that keep our troops connected, they manage the system that supports intelligence gathering. And fairly soon, they're going to control the vehicles that deorbit the space station. We're basically handing what was once our government to a handful of billionaires who are not accountable to you or I. They're not accountable to the country. They're accountable to their shareholders. So every time we give up more of our public functions, every time it's carved off and auctioned off, we lose another piece of our control, our sovereignty, our accountability. And look, innovation and efficiency sound like nice words. But the reality is, as we've talked about before, privatization is just creating more corporations who are too big and too powerful to fail. And every time they get themselves into trouble, what do? They come back and twist our arms for bailouts, for more for them, less for us. And this is where Congress had better wake up. We should be holding hearings on national security issues like SpaceX. And we should be clawing that stuff back into the hands of we the people, not someone like Elon Musk. It's not good for the country. It's not good for us. And no privatization scheme has been good for us, especially we in the working class. So as Trump and his sycophants do what they do, privatize, profitize, whether it's education, roads and bridges. It's our job to remember come election time. It's our job to remember that no privatization scheme has ever worked out for working people. It's always been the screw job. We pay more, we get less. But at least we have a billionaire class second to none. And history will remember us for this. History will remember us as having the largest billionaire class ever. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you check out the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Stephanie Officer. Harvard University appeared in federal court today to challenge $2.6 billion in funding cuts by the Trump administration. The university accuses the government of using funding as leverage to control its academic decisions. The cuts followed Harvard's rejection of administration demands for sweeping changes to policies on campus protests, admissions, hiring, and more. Harvard grads like Anamora Bargava held a rally Monday in support of the university.
Their position is this, which is that they can cancel any contract, any funding that they want to, based on changing agency priorities without regard for the Constitution or for any of the procedures under federal statutes.
Texas officials say most of the more than 160 people originally reported missing along the Guadalupe River after the deadly July 4th floods were safe, and only three people still haven't been found. The flash floods killed at least 135 people in Texas. This is ABC News. We are hearing now.